everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for It's All About Food. And thank you once again for joining me. If you're new to this program, thank you. What we talk about on this show, It's All About Food. Try and guess. We talk about food. And for me, food is related to just about everything in life. And food can help us feel good. Food can make us feel bad. Food is connected to a lot of political issues, poverty, and cruelty for humans and non-humans. Food is a powerful thing. We can't live without food, at least not for very long. And I love food. And what I love about the food that I choose to eat is that it's the gentlest on the planet and is so delicious. And I feel so good eating it. Every bite, all the time. I get very excited about food. We post a lot of healthy recipes on our nonprofit website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And we're coming to the end of the year. And this is a time when a lot of nonprofits have fundraisers, and we've put up an end of the year report. You're welcome to go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and learn more about us and our accomplishments this year. You can read about that. And something I don't talk about much on this program is one of the things that we do other than archiving and transcribing this weekly show, which we've been doing for almost 8 years, and creating lots of wonderful recipes that we offer for you for no charge. You know, I'm a cancer survivor of advanced ovarian cancer. And one of the things that I do is offer a free consultation for people that are going through cancer. We do coaching at Responsible Eating and Living, and most of the time helping people transition to a healthy diet, we do that for a fee. But for someone who's in an emergency crisis, I am happy to speak with them and share with them my experience and provide resources that I believe can be very helpful. So I just want you to know that. And if you know someone who's in a crisis like that, you can have them email me at info@realmeals.org. And while we're in the holiday spirit and gift giving, I just want you to know if you do donate to responsibleeatingandliving.com for $35 or more, you can receive a book that I was a part of this year, 25 Women Who Survived Cancer, Inspiring Stories of Hope. And people like Fran Drescher have contributed to this book, and Patty LuPone, Robin Roberts, Ruth Heydrich. There are some wonderful stories in here. They're very inspiring. If you know someone in a crisis and you want to give them a great book, or you just want to share inspiring stories from many women who have survived cancer, this is a great book, and we're giving it to you for free with a $35 or more donation to responsibleeatingandliving.com. Find out more at our website. Okay? Awesome. Now, let's move to my first guest. Ashley Melillo is a school psychologist and the writer, photographer, and recipe creator behind Blissful Basil, a blog dedicated to unearthing the happiest side of life through wholesome plant-based foods. With roots in both psychology and plant-based nutrition, Ashley is fascinated with the way that diet and lifestyle choices affect physical, cognitive, and emotional wellness. She incorporates a wide array of natural health-enhancing ingredients into her recipes with the hope of guiding others on their path towards improved well-being, all while enjoying delicious food. You can have your health and eat cake, too. She holds a certificate in plant-based nutrition from the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, and her recipes have been featured in Women's Health, Red Book, The Huffington Post, and Shape, among others. She lives in Chicago with her husband, Dan, and orange tabby cat, Jack. And we're going to be talking about her book, Blissful Basil, Over 100 Plant-Powered Recipes to Unearth Vibrancy, Health, and Happiness. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me.
And I am happy whenever I hear about people who are out there doing what I think is so important, and that is sharing healthy, delicious food that is so good for us and great for the planet and is the best tasting stuff around.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, I get a little too excited about it, and I read your book and really enjoyed it. And some of the recipes, we'll dig into that later because they're really creative. There are some interesting mixes in here that I haven't seen, which is exciting.
Well, thank you. That is exciting.
It is, because we do a lot of cooking here, and it's just nice when something grabs my attention. Now, I want to dig into anxiety a little bit. You talk about it quite a bit in your book and your personal experience with anxiety, and now you're a school psychologist. This is an interesting time with the political atmosphere. A lot of people are feeling anxiety. Some of us are born with it. Some of us have had trauma, and some of us are just feeling it because these are crazy times. So let's talk about anxiety and how food can help.
Yes. So without going into all the details of the story, my personal experience has really been that food has been able to provide this sort of peace and contentment within my life by eating healthier whole foods, plant-based meals. And I think just in general with anxiety, you know, I think it's tempting to think that maybe there's this quick fix, whether you're feeling anxiety for a specific time, you know, regarding the election or related to that or whatever it might be, or the events going on in the world, or if you have been fighting it throughout your life. I think it's tempting to think that there might be this sort of quick fix. And what I've really found for myself, and I think this holds true for a lot of people, just based on my experiences as a psychologist too, is that there are fixes, but it's sort of building up these habits and making these small choices day in and day out that really vote in favor of your entire well-being and your health all around. So your cognitive, mental, and emotional health, and your physical health as well. So I think when you have all those components in place, and when they're all kind of aligning and jiving with one another, then it helps alleviate that anxiety and provide a sense of peace.
I can't talk enough about planning and being organized, but when your mind is foggy or your mind is full of fear and there are voices and so many things clouding your rational side, it's especially hard to take even the littlest steps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can. Yeah, I totally know that feeling when I think especially when you're feeling that sort of heightened anxiety and it's at the peak, it can feel almost paralyzing to try and move forward. And I think that's always the hardest step is when you're feeling that, or whether it's depression or anxiety, you know, I think any sort of like mental health difficulty or even just very overwhelming level of stress, no matter what it is, when it's at that heightened state, it can be so difficult to take that first step forward. But I think just making those tiny steps. So for me, that would be eating a healthy plant-based meal, or if it's getting myself into a yoga class, something like that. The hardest things to do in those moments are often the things that are going to propel us forward and ultimately are the best things for us. And they are the ones that are going to sort of alleviate some of that and start to chip away at those intense, sort of stressful, anxiety-ridden feelings, and allow us to start to take the other steps that we need to do in order to alleviate some of those feelings.
Now, to add on to all of that, we have seasonal affective disorder, and here we are, it's December in New York, where I am. So seasonal affective disorder can affect people differently based on where they live and how much sunshine they have. You kept mentioning November as being your trigger month. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk a little bit about seasonal affective disorder and what we can do about it.
Yes. So seasonal affective disorder, and it can swing both ways. For some people, it can actually affect them in the summer and cause sort of more manic symptoms and things like that. For me, it always strikes in the winter time. And I think that sort of time shift that happens in November when the clocks roll back and we have even less daylight, or the daylight hours, you know, just end much earlier. So the sun goes down around 4 or 4:30 this time of year. It really can intensify those feelings. And that's often when people start feeling either depressed or anxious. In the past, there wasn't as much known about the sort of anxiety that goes along with seasonal affective, but it is becoming a more common understanding of that. So it can be these overlapping sort of depressed or flat affect feelings along with anxiety. And in order to help that, I mean, there are many things you can do, from light boxes, which you can just sit in front of a light box for 30 minutes a day. That's often something people will do. But my approach has really been sort of a collection of habits that are simple, but implemented on a daily basis have a very, very powerful effect. And so for me, that's really been sort of exercise, finding peace and calm through meditation or yoga. And then the thing that's really provided the most consistent level of relief from the seasonal affective has been eating a whole foods plant-based diet and adhering to that as closely as I can, with a little bit of flexibility too. I think it's important to have an element of self-compassion and understanding if, you know, you're craving something that's maybe not the thing that makes you feel greatest, but it just is what you're feeling that you want to eat in that moment. So like a vegan cookie or more processed vegan pizza, something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a repetitive theme on this program, and we hear it a lot, and that is that exercise, a whole food plant-based diet, meditation, and a subtitle of exercise is yoga, which kind of links to meditation, and self-love. This is a recipe for feeling good, all of these things. And I was happy to hear in your personal story that your husband came along and you had that great support and love behind you. I think love is probably the most important of all of these ingredients. And when we are not feeling love, it's especially hard to accomplish any of these things. I like to say tune in love on this program, and I like to send out love to everyone that's listening and kind of feel it come back to me. But can you talk a little bit about love?
Yes, I completely agree. I think it's so important when you're kind of emanating those vibrations of love and putting out that energy into the world. It really does circle back. And I think just having that support from family, friends, acquaintances, it's just absolutely imperative to feeling supported and healthy and implementing things in your life that allow you to thrive. It's so much easier when you have a support network and people that believe in you. And even if they don't understand the exact steps that you're taking, or the habits or choices or lifestyle that you're following, just to know that that support is there from them and that they're willing to listen is all that matters and can make or break your efforts.
And there are people who are alone and don't feel love. And if you're listening, and if I'm talking to you right now, I want you to know I'm sending you love right now. I'm sending the world love. And I'm doing it somewhat selfishly because it feels good. Like you said, it comes back to us. But what the world needs now is love, sweet love, more than ever. I have to keep reminding myself of that. And that's why I like to tune in love during this hour. Now, let's talk about how we do that with your food in particular. So let's say we're having a difficult day, that afternoon slump has come around. What do you recommend?
Oh, gosh. It really depends on the type of sort of snack cravings that you have. But for me, I love an afternoon juice. There's actually a juice in the book. There's only one juice recipe in the entire book, but it's one that I recommend in the afternoon because it kind of perks up my spirit and just offers a big boost of energy. It has a bit of a kick to it because there's a little bit of jalapeno in the juice itself. So that one's great. I also love smoothies. I think it's really difficult to go wrong with a good smoothie. And I think especially bananas and things like that have a lot of mood boosting tryptophan and other minerals and vitamins that just tend to energize us. Those are great. And then if you like a heartier pick-me-up, then there's really great trail mix bars or cookies in the book and a whole variety of things.
Yes, yum. It does take energy, though, and I'm just wondering how the best way to motivate and inspire people to plan and organize and prepare, as you said, prepare to conquer instead of prepare to fail in your book. That first boost, it's like, you know, we all know we should exercise, and once we're in the gym and once we finish, we're like, we're so glad we did it. But that momentum to get there, that momentum to get into the kitchen. Do you have any prepare, plan, tricks that have helped you along the way?
Yes. So a couple, and a couple for a different points in terms of where you're at in making something. So for example, for grocery shopping, I used to find that to be an incredibly daunting task at the end of a long day. And I think a lot of us do, especially if the grocery store is really busy. So I finally, a few years ago, started making a habit that on my way home from work on Thursday or Friday, usually Friday, I would stop at the same grocery store right around the same time, and I would grocery shop then. And I think because it was at the end of the week, that sort of end of the week momentum really inspired me and carried me through the aisles and just made it less of a daunting task and just more of a, I don't know, it almost became enjoyable. And seeing the same people working at the store and other shoppers, it just, the routine and habit around that, I think, is so important. Of course, it always is hard in the beginning, but if you can put in that effort to get going at first, it does start to reinforce and sustain itself in terms of that, building that habit up. And then another thing I love to do is to set aside a period of time on Sunday and just prepare some of the meals for my week in advance. So preparing bigger batches. So like with the trail mix cookies, that's not something that you're going to whip up in the afternoon when you're taking a break from work or something like that. You'd really want to prepare it ahead of time and then have a whole supply of things ready for you to grab on a moment's notice. And that to me is a huge help during the week, because it's really tempting to reach for something that maybe isn't going to make us feel the best if we're not prepared or haven't taken the time to make better, healthier choices readily available for ourselves.
My favorite way of looking at planning and preparing things for myself in the future is to think of it as a gift to myself in the future. So when I'm drinking that green juice that I had made, what I like to do is I make green juice for the week. I have a green juice every day and I freeze them. And when I take that out and I'm drinking it once it's defrosted, it's like this great gift that I made for myself. Anytime there's something ready to go in the refrigerator, it's like, thank you. And it's this great self-love. So when we're talking about tuning in love, you can think about the things you don't like to do. And if you can turn it around and think it's a way to love yourself, a way to show gratitude for you, and then you get to reap the benefits later.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree, Karen. And I heard this quote, it was about a year ago, and it was around the time I was finishing up the book and just feeling really overwhelmed with cooking for myself and making sure that I was preparing things ahead of time. Because I think it happens to the best of us, even if you're used to making things and making all these meals, it still can just be overwhelming if you're having a busy week or depending on the time of year or what's going on. And this quote I heard, it was basically shifting this sort of mental dialogue that goes on in all of our heads that often says, I should do this or I need to do this, to I want to do this. And I think that aligns with that sort of self-love mentality. Like, I want to take care of myself, so I want to make these foods, or I want to go to the gym and work out, or I want to go to yoga class. So just that little shift really helped me in that moment. And it sounds so small and kind of silly, but it really does make a big difference when we think about what we want to do for ourselves rather than what we feel like we have to do.
Absolutely. And it's the little things, because we can feel so overwhelmed. If we can just make subtle little changes, that'll make a big difference. That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what I do, I have a nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, and I've been a broken record for decades because I became a vegetarian as a teenager and a vegan at 30, and I'm 58 now. So I've been vegan for 28 years, and I've like read every book, and I've got a ton of cookbooks, and it's all about plant food for me forever. And I can preach. And what I've learned to do is only offer information when people ask.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't want to give it to people who don't want it. But I can often be in a conversation with someone who has asked and has expressed concern about pains they're feeling or some way they're not feeling well, and I offer information that might be helpful. And I always tell these people that it's their choice. They can choose to do whatever they want to do. I'm not going to tell them what to do, but I offer information. But sometimes I get back the excuses why they can't do what I'm suggesting. What is that? And what do you recommend for people that are just continually knocking themselves down about why they can't do something that'll make them feel better?
This is a tough one for me. I think from a psychologist's perspective too, working with adolescents, you know, there's a lot of excuses. We all have excuses for why we're not doing something. I have learned to come from the perspective of someone really has to be ready. Like I think their curiosity and asking the questions is sort of the first step in moving towards finding that solution for themselves, him or herself. But until they're ready to adopt new habits and to do the hard work, because new habits are hard to implement. You know, I think that's a thing. We want something easy, but oftentimes the best things for us are more difficult to implement. It's not sort of a quick fix thing. And we really have to, I think that's where that self-love comes in too. Like you really have to love yourself to implement these habits or these changes, because it does take some work and it does take a commitment. So I do come from the perspective that I think people have to be ready to make that change. But just in asking the questions, to me, that's saying, okay, well, I'm curious about this. And the more curious you become, the more connected and aware you become to how maybe those habits are helping other people, or in both of our cases, how a plant-based lifestyle is allowing us to live life more fully and allowing us to thrive.
Very good. Now you work with children. What age groups?
I work with high schoolers. So
okay.
Yeah, so 14 to 18. Predominantly the school I'm at is divided into two schools, and the portion I'm at is sophomores through seniors in high school.
Those are very difficult ages.
Yes, they can be. I love them though. They're very inspiring and full of life for sure.
Yeah. But it's a time when the hormones are raging and things can be very challenging and confusing. These very often, we're so concerned with everyone's opinion around us, and we haven't developed a strong foundation in ourselves. It's very an emotional time, and I know food plays a big picture. Do you have any consistent recommendations with regard to food and teenagers?
For the teenagers that I work with, I often won't go there unless the parents are asking or unless they're curious, just because it's technically outside of my realm when I'm within the school boundaries.
Sure.
But when students are curious, I oftentimes, if I mention that I'm vegan, they start asking questions why. So I really try and just talk about what food has done for me and how it's benefited me in my life. But I think in general, I will try and steer students away. Like if they're feeling very energetically down and just are having difficulties with getting up in the morning, things like that, I'll often inquire about diet and just So, you know, try and nudge them back, because some of these kids are, I mean, they're eating predominantly candy and very processed foods throughout the day. And it's almost impossible to feel our best when the food is so, so highly processed and so packed with sugar. So I will ask questions.
Absolutely. I'm thumbing through your book and the pictures are gorgeous. I'm looking at some recipes that are absolutely irresistible. Superseded pesto pizza with the rainbow veggies, mozzarella, and sweet potato crust.
Yes, that's a favorite. That's actually on the cover too.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, that's right. Yeah, I'm licking the page. It just looks so good. And there's nothing bad in here.
Oh, thank you.
It's all good food. And then right now, there's just a few right next to each other that just look amazing. Mushroom lentil sliders with herbed hemp aioli.
Those are a favorite. And all these recipes too were tested. All of the recipe testers that I worked with were meat eaters. So none of them are vegetarian or vegan. I really wanted everyone to love the recipes in this book. So
yeah, that's important. You know, I know, we put up a lot of recipes on our website, and even when we test them, like my partner Gary will make a recipe and then I'll make it. It's never the same. Everybody's got a unique style. So you learn a lot when different people coming from different backgrounds and may not have the same appliances or anything try a recipe out.
Oh, absolutely. It is interesting what some of the feedback will say. And it translates very differently to different kitchens. Even just an oven can make the world of difference in how something bakes. So it's important to kind of take all of that into consideration when you're writing recipes.
Absolutely. I just want to mention one more recipe because this picture is just crazy. And that's the shaved carrot Reuben with special sauce and Swiss cheese. And those little folded pieces of carrot, you know what they look like.
Yes. Yeah, that is one of the recipes I'm probably most proud of, just because I haven't seen it done before. And it just, the idea just kind of came to me out of nowhere. And I was like, you know, I'm curious about this, but I honestly wasn't sure it would work out and it really did.
It's genius. It looks like cold cuts. You know, when you see an advertisement for a cold cut sandwich and they roll the cold cuts up, well, the carrots here are folded just like that. And it really looks fantastic. I can't wait to try that.
Thank you. Yes, you'll have to try it. It's really, really good.
Well, Ashley, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. And you're doing amazing work with your blog, Blissful Basil, and with your new book of the same name, Blissful Basil. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, happy holidays.
You too.
Okay. All right, that was Ashley Melillo. Check out her new cookbook, Blissful Basil. It's really stunning, beautiful. I love the recipes. Okay, now I just wanted to say before we take a quick break and bring on my next guest, somehow I never remember to bring this up, but you know, this is a live call-in show, and if you are listening live, even though I know most of you are listening later, you can call in with comments and questions. I love to hear from you. The number is 1-888-874-4888, and you can always email me at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. All right. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we will be speaking with Stephen M. Wise of the Non-Human Rights Project. Hi, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me for the second part of today's program, and I want to get right to it with my guest, Stephen M. Wise. He is the president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He holds a JD from Boston University Law School and a BS in chemistry from the College of William and Mary. He has practiced animal protection law for 30 years throughout the United States and is admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. Steve teaches animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont, Lewis, and Clark University of Miami and St. Thomas Law Schools, and he has taught animal rights law at the Harvard Law School and John Marshall Law School. He's the author of four books, Rattling the Cage, Drawing the Line, Through the Heavens May Fall, and my favorite, an American trilogy, Death, Slavery, and Dominion Along the Banks of the Cape Fear River. He is also working on a fifth, which will be a memoir about the Non-Human Rights Project. Welcome to It's All About Food. Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome, and I hope you had a very happy birthday yesterday.
I did, yes. Thank you. Thank you.
It was, I don't know, it was an odd day for us, kind of with this strange bit of hope that the Electoral College would turn a different way, but it didn't. But aside from that, we have much work to do. So I had the opportunity to meet you a few weeks ago. You were speaking in Brooklyn, and yep. It was great to hear you in person. I want to, what impressed me the most, I don't know why I just realized it at that point in time when you were speaking, but how you are working to move the law in such a tiny increment. And I was just fascinated by that and your approach and your patience. Can you talk a little about that work?
Sure. Well, I do have a lot of patience. I'm very persistent. I had begun working as an animal protection lawyer in 1981, and I began working with what became the Animal Legal Defense Fund. I became president of that for 10 years. And by 1985, 1986, I'd been persuaded that there was a real problem with respect to how the law dealt with non-human animals, that the law saw them all as legal things, which means that they lacked the capacity to have any kind of legal rights, as opposed to legal persons, which is the capacity to have at least some legal rights. And that until non-human animals were seen as persons, they could be expected to be treated just like human beings treat all their other property. They don't act in the interest of their property. They act in their own interests. And essentially, a person is the master of things. Things are slaves to us persons. And so I began to plan how we would begin to move at least some non-human animals from the legal category of things, again, who lack the capacity for any kind of legal right, to legal persons who have the capacity for at least some. And the ones we're looking for are those that protect their most fundamental interests. And at that time, I thought it would take 1985, 86, I thought it would take about 30 years of preparation before we'd be able to even file the first lawsuits that had some kind of a reasonable chance of success. And there was so much to do because if you can go back to 1985, there was very little talk of animal rights in any kind of a technical legal way. There weren't very many lawyers. There were no case books. There were no law schools who taught it. There were no law review articles about it. There were no organizations except the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And also, the world was in a very different place with respect to non-human animals. And so altogether, I figured it would take probably 30 years before the world had turned and we had prepared for those kinds of cases. And it did indeed take 28 years. That 1985 is when I began, and then the Non-Human Rights Project began filing its first series of lawsuits on behalf of chimpanzees in the state of New York, habeas corpus lawsuits, in December of 2013.
That's a lot of patience and a lot of wonderful foresight. So thank you for getting started that so long ago.
Well, there's a film out about us called Unlocking the Cage by Chris Hedges and D.A. Pennybaker, which actually is going to be on HBO on February 20th on President's Day. And I remember going in and speaking with them about whether – and they're trying to figure out whether they're going to shoot the film. And they wanted to see me, and I thought they probably want to see whether I'm a lunatic or whether I'm serious about this. Because if you say – someone had an idea and it's going to take them 28 years before they can move on it, you could either be a lunatic or you could be somebody who's deadly serious. And I think they realized soon that I was deadly serious, and they agreed to make the film. And indeed, it took 4 years to make, and it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and now it's been playing around the world, and it's going on HBO on February 20th.
Well, congratulations, and I look forward to seeing it. I remember when it came here to New York, and unfortunately, I was in California for a good amount of that time, so I missed it when it was here, and I look forward to seeing it in February. I'm going to have to find somebody who has HBO.
Indeed.
But I think I can do that. All right, so you've expanded the mission of the Non-Human Rights Project. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, we originally were planning on just filing lawsuits, and specifically we began by filing habeas corpus lawsuits on behalf of captive chimpanzees. We've begun moving that to filing other sorts of lawsuits in states other than the state of New York on behalf of other animals. So our next lawsuit will be on behalf of elephants in a circus. We have a lawsuit after that. We'll probably go after chimpanzees being used in entertainment, where we always have an idea. We're looking at SeaWorld in San Diego and trying to figure out how we may be able to file lawsuits against SeaWorld. But we're also moving into the legislative department, not at the state level or the federal level, but we've been working on how to try to get ordinances passed that would make certain non-human animals legal persons who have the capacity for rights at the municipal level, at the county level, or at the city level, at the town level. And so we're beginning to do that. We're beginning to get more deeply into a public education program, basically so that we can continue to make people understand why we're doing what we're doing. And also we think that will make it easier for us to win at the legislative level as well as in front of judges, because they'll have a much better idea as to, from a legal point of view, why we're doing what we're doing. But also we never do anything on behalf of a non-human animal that we haven't already lined up the world's great experts in the cognition of that non-human animal. And so they will then, judges, legislators, and others will be able to really get an idea as to what kind of extraordinary minds so many of these non-human animals have. And we're beginning to focus, we focus first on the great apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas and orangutans, also on Indian Asian and African elephants, as well as some dolphins and whales. Those are the non-human animals who we're starting with. And one of the reasons we're starting with them is because there is so much known about their minds that it's clear that they have these extraordinarily complex minds. And we want other people to understand what we understand by getting all sorts of facts together, lining up experts, and letting people know, you know, what kind of beings we're living with on this planet.
Something that fascinated me when I heard you speak in Brooklyn as well is talking about the law and how you can make changes in the law, kind of how it builds on itself. And right now, a lot of us are feeling a lot of despair because of the future of the federal government with the man who will be president very soon and who he's choosing to be part of his cabinet and staff. And it's somewhat scary. And some of us are thinking that our civil rights are going to be taken away to some degree. But you're focusing on working on the state level, and now you're talking about the municipal level. And tell me why that's important.
Well, I think it's important because, first of all, they're independent. We work on state common law, actually. And the common law is the law that judges make while they're in the process of deciding cases. And it doesn't have anything to do with federal law at all. So there could be a lot of things going on at the federal level that would not affect us because we're working at the common law level, which – and the common law has been around for 800 or 900 years. and it slowly changes, but it's made to be flexible, to change according to how the public experience changes, public mores change, how scientific facts continue to accrue. And so the arguments we have been making and continue to make at the common law level, we'll continue to make no matter who's sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court or who's sitting on the federal benches. At the municipal level, we're actually looking at those states that have so-called constitutional home rule, which means that within their state constitutions, there are provisions that allow them to legislate in a way that they cannot be overridden at the state level. And they're almost like little states themselves. The cities and towns within that state have the power of the state. And so we want to go into to make our arguments at a smaller level, like a county level or city level, as well as making common law arguments at the state level. We think it's the way to really get our foot into the door. And so mm-hmm. that's why we've chosen that. Once you go to the federal level, you're dealing with either federal statutes, which there are very, very few federal statutes that protect non-human animals, or you're dealing with federal courts who rarely have jurisdiction over non-human animal issues. So we think starting at the state level and the municipal level is the way that we want to begin.
Can you tell us what's going on around the world on this subject? I think there's some positive things that have been happening.
I can tell you. Yes, one of the non-human rights project might be working at the municipal level on the state level, and we skip our federal level, but we skip right up to the international level. And so we have been working slowly with lawyers in, I think, 10 countries now, France, in England, Switzerland, Spain, Portugal, Argentina, Brazil, India, Australia, New Zealand, trying to impart whatever help we can give to them to try to get legal rights for non-human animals, and working with them to so we can share whatever experience we have, and we may be able to learn from them as well. And I think the country where we're having the most success is Argentina, there was a case about 2 months ago where a chimpanzee in Mendoza, Argentina, where a chimpanzee named Cecilia was also the subject of a writ of habeas corpus that was really modeled on our work, and the arguments made about the cognition of Cecilia, a chimpanzee, was also modeled on our work. So we were really happy to see that. And also, I had spent a week down in Buenos Aires and Bahia Blanca in Argentina in May, speaking with lawyers. So I knew how eager people were to be able to push this sort of thing forward. So a judge then did indeed grant a writ of habeas corpus and ordered a chimpanzee named Cecilia to be taken from the Mendoza Zoo and sent to a sanctuary in Brazil. And so I think that's really the first time at least that a writ of habeas corpus has been used successfully all the way. We have been successful. We've had a judge in Manhattan issue a writ of habeas corpus, or in New York they would call it an order to show cause. That was the first time that it happened in the world. And that required Stony Brook, who was imprisoning two chimpanzees named Hercules and Leos, to actually come into court and defend for the first time in history their imprisonment of a non-human animal. When we had the habeas corpus hearing, the judge ruled in our favor all the way down the line, except for one thing. She felt bound by a previous ruling in another part of New York that had gone against us. And so she said, I'm going to have to deny your writ of habeas corpus, quote, for now, unquote. And now we're actually going into an appellate court in New York City in January on behalf of Tommy the chimpanzee, and the same appellate court in February on behalf of Kiko the chimpanzee, trying to persuade that court to tell the judge who had ruled against us that she doesn't have to pay attention to that other case, that case was decided wrongly.
So you keep chipping away, and these judges look for kind of an excuse because they don't have the courage to rule in favor of your
judges.
Case.
You know, they're not all cut from the same cloth. You know, some judges are very conservative. Some judges are much more liberal. Some are willing to have their picture on the front page of newspapers. Some are not willing to have their picture on the front page of newspapers. And they're broad and diverse kinds of judges. And so we really can't pick the ones we're going in front of. And so we kind of make our arguments in front of the judges we get. And even in the first 3 years, we've gotten a wide variety of judges. And some judges we've done much better in front of than others. So, in fact, when you watch the film, which, by the way, is called Unlocking the Cage, you can watch one or two judges kind of ring me out about what I'm trying to do. And then you can find other judges who are very, very sympathetic to it. And it's just kind of how they're made, what their value systems are. And also what kind of a case they think we're filing. For example, do they think we're filing a property case because a chimpanzee's property? Or do they think we're filing a civil rights case because we're asking for a legal right for a non-human animal? So we think a judge who kind of intuitively believes that she has a property case in front of her is going to rule against us, while a judge who kind of intuitively thinks that she has a civil rights case in front of her may tend to rule in our favor. So we have an immense amount of patience, and we just apply as much pressure as we can. We also speak to our brothers and sisters in the legal profession by continuing to write and publish series of law review articles in which we explain at much greater length the legal arguments that we're using in our cases so that judges and lawyers and law clerks can read them and understand what we're doing. And it's also something that we can cite to in our briefs. And again, the judges or their clerks can go to these articles and get a better understanding than they might be able to get even by reading our briefs, because there's always a page limit on our briefs, but there's not really a page limit on our books or law review articles. An oral argument in front of a judge may end up taking 15 minutes. So there's not a whole lot that you can really talk about in 15 minutes. So
I'm just curious I'm curious about Stony Brook and what their argument was to keep these animals imprisoned.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not really clear what it is sometimes. You can watch the lawyer for Stony Brook, who is an assistant attorney general, make the arguments. I think the most important arguments were, number one, judge, this has never been done before. You shouldn't do it now. And that's the argument that anybody makes who wants to keep the status quo. When someone else comes in and says, hey, it's time because of new scientific evidence or changes in the law, it's time to move something in a different direction. The person doesn't want to move. They'll say, hey, we don't know what's going to happen. We shouldn't be doing this. That kind of argument they make all the time. And then they make another kind of argument, which in law is known as the slippery slope, which is, judge, if you grant habeas corpus to a chimpanzee and get her out of her cell and put her in a sanctuary, well, that means then chimpanzees are going to want to come in and they're going to want to vote, and they're going to want to go to college, they're going to want to get married, and so you shouldn't start down this dangerous trail. It's the slippery slope. And the judge, actually, in her opinion, in the Stony Brook case, specifically addressed this slippery slope argument and said, I don't buy it. If the party in front of me is entitled to justice, he'll get it. And then we'll let the next judge decide the next case, which I think is the appropriate answer to a slippery slope argument.
Okay. Steve, this is difficult. This work, this is challenging work. This is time-consuming work. It costs money. How can we help? What can people do?
Well, if you would like to donate to us, you're certainly you can go to our website, which is www.nonhumanrights.org, and you'll find a donate button. And also, you will find that everything that we file or everything an opponent files or everything a judge does, everything, whether we like it or not, goes up on our website. We're also the website that you see in December is not going to be the website that's going to go up in January, because we're spending money to really change our whole website to make it much, much easier for people to follow. And also, if you're interested in just working anywhere in the United States, really anywhere in the world, for the same sorts of things that the Non-Human Rights Project is interested in, we are expanding. We're beginning to actually put people into district captains kind of in each state. And so we'll be able to talk with you, not right now, but by March or April, we'll be able to talk to you about what you might be able to do to help our work in the state in which you are living.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen
Wise. Thank you so much for having me on.
Right. Yes. Thank you for keeping it up for so many decades, doing what you're doing.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, happy holidays. All right, that was Stephen M. Wise of the Non-Human Rights Project. You can find more at the nonhumanrights.org website, www.nonhumanrights.org. How awesome is that for someone to be working for the voiceless and improving the legal rights for those who are sentient and are smart and cannot represent themselves in our legal system, which is so abusive to them. Okay, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to bring you back to responsibilityandliving.com, where we work to make life lovely and delicious while making it better for the planet and better for those non-human animals that many choose to look at as food, which we at responsibilityandliving.com do not. And we give you all the good reasons not to consume animals for food, because the food is so yummy and delicious. You know, we were talking about anxiety before and energy, and we make these super duper green power smoothies at home. And when we do, I just can't believe how sated I am and how much energy I have all day long. So if you're looking to really be energized, you might try one of these. They are green. They are super green. And they are fully loaded with all good things. And you can find it at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Again, I want to mention, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that responsibleeatingandliving.com is a nonprofit, and I am offering for those who donate $35 or more this book, 25 Women Who Survived Cancer, Notable Women Sharing Inspiring Stories of Hope. I have contributed a chapter, and at Responsibility and Living, we do offer free consultations for people in a health crisis with cancer. And you can help support our work doing that with a donation. And you can also get a book. It makes a great stocking stuffer. All right. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. And you can find me at info@realmeals.org if you have some comments and questions. We are here to serve deliciously. Okay. Have a really delicious week.